Chapter 13. Their Incredible Essence. There's a very inconvenient postscript to the story of Humphrey the Humpback, the whale that got lost near Antioch Dunes. And I worry that it might spoil the uplifting resolution of the rescue's final scene, how crowds lined the Golden Gate Bridge in the fog to watch the whale return to the ocean, how Humphrey paused underneath them to swim in circles, leap repeatedly out of the water, and slap its tail as though, as Isla's picture book about Humphrey's adventure described it, the whale was saying goodbye and thank you to all his friends who had helped save his life, and how a government spokesman, relieved though still stumped about why the whale came upstream in the first place, could only tell the media, "Now all we can do is keep our fingers crossed and hope he doesn't come back." The problem is, Humphrey did come back. One morning, 5 years later, in October 1990, the same humpback, identified by markings on its tail fin, swam into San Francisco Bay and promptly beached itself in the mud beside a low-lying stretch of highway near Candlestick Park, tying up rush hour traffic. It took only 2 days to turn Humphrey around this time, though the whale nearly died in the process. People tended to the animal around the clock, draping wet towels over its exposed skin. The incomprehensible persistence with which Humphrey had now twice, unmistakably, swum straight into civilization made it clear how little we knew about the whale. For one thing, scientists only now discovered that Humphrey was actually a female. That void was filled with lots of wide-ranging speculation. One theory was that Humphrey was a forerunner of a new species, trying to take an evolutionary leap onto land. And it was the not knowing that made the animal's predicament even more painful to watch. "I just wish we could talk to him," one woman on the side of the road told the press. I thought about Humphrey while tracking the long genesis of Operation Migration's work, how, over two decades, the entire collage of peculiar ideas had been pasted together into the costume spectacle I was now watching. Layered inside that history, I picked up on a certain longing for closeness and collaboration with animals, for mutual understanding, and for proof that the wall between our world and theirs is an illusion, that we can enter their world and help them, and solve problems by working closely together. It's what made George Archibald's Dancing with Tex feel magical to the public, even as George himself felt browbeaten by the work. And it's what Squire Babcock seemed to be moved by, but still struggling to express, outside the church in Kentucky. Ultimately, what all those craniacs and I were gathering in the cold to watch was really a kind of interspecies communication. It was a very rudimentary and not so romantic kind, but something was being genuinely said and understood. The white costumes were saying, "Follow me." Lately, a small genre of YouTube videos has cropped up centering on these momentary and almost metaphysical close encounters between people and wild animals. The woman who manages to cuddle with an elephant seal on a beach, for example. Or the middle-aged American tourist who sits stock still on a rock in Uganda while a troop of mountain gorillas calmly encircles him. Soon, the juvenile gorillas clamber up the back of the man's shirt to inspect and groom his silver hair, as though initiating him into their ranks. The astonished, euphoric look on these people's faces is always the same. "I'm a gorilla," the tourist says in a quavering whisper when the gorillas have finally trudged off. It's a look we'd never expect to see on someone rooting around with pigs in a barnyard, or even nuzzling a pet golden retriever. That glee, that flash of illumination, only seems to come from finding equal footing with the wild ones. It seems to be underwritten by a hazy belief that they have something to teach us, that glimpsing what is common between us and the animals elevates rather than degrades our humanity. It's why William Lishman first raced into the air to fly with geese in the summer of 1985, and why, a few months later, clear across the continent, so many ordinary people felt called to help Humphrey the lost whale, and why they felt called to help Humphrey again 5 years after that. For most of American history, whales were seen as commodities to be cracked open for their oil. But by October 1990, Even an average commuter from San Jose, standing on the side of the highway, could be found making sense of Humphrey's return by telling a reporter from USA Today, "Whales are so intelligent. I think they're connected somehow to a supreme intellect in the universe, and he's here to help us somehow." I don't know when this reverence for animals was forged. Lots of indigenous cultures, of course, felt roughly the same way about the animals they encountered. But if there was a tipping point, a moment when it was obvious that such feelings were permeating the mainstream, it was probably around the day in the mid-1970s when a woman named Joan McIntyre was paid a phenomenal sum of money to speak at a retreat for IBM's Golden Circle of top-performing salesmen in San Francisco. With trippy footage of whales and dolphins projected behind her, she looked out on what appeared to her to be 2,000 men in identical suits and haircuts and began to explain, rather rhapsodically, how wonderfully liberated these animals are and how they make love in all possible combinations, mothers and sons, fathers and daughters, brothers and sisters. It was the era of free love, and McIntyre, a conservationist cut from a new kind of cloth, saw no reason why humanity couldn't extend its love to whales. Joan McIntyre, then in her early 40s, was a glamorous and sharp-witted hippie from Berkeley who still carried the spirit of a 22-year-old. She'd recently spearheaded an anti-fur campaign for the environmental group Friends of the Earth, and now had a large grant, no strings attached, to pursue a new cause. Her interest in whales was piqued in part by Songs of the Humpback Whale, a record album of male humpbacks' haunting croaks and bellows released in 1970. The recordings, made in Bermuda and Hawaii by Roger Payne and Scott McVeigh, represented a step forward for science. Few people, aside from top-secret Navy engineers, knew that humpbacks vocalized. The American counterculture was also drawn to whale song as though it were nature's lava lamp, a swirling psychedelic bath of sound to lose oneself in. Even the music critic for the New York Times suggested listening to Songs of the Humpback Whale in a dark room and getting in touch with your mammalian past. In an interview, McIntyre later explained that something about those moaning animals tapped into feelings of loneliness that she'd carried with her since childhood. Her father died when she was very young, and her mother shuttled her between Chicago and Los Angeles, chasing work during the Depression. She was a solitary child and disappeared into the many books about fictional animals that were popular at the time, nature fakeresque tales whose animal protagonists were often friendless or abandoned. When she got involved in anti-fur activism in the late 60s, as an adult, it was because she could not stop herself from feeling empathy for those fur seals and minks, actually feeling it. It was as though at some point in her youth, McIntyre had learned to see the world of animal sentiment and suffering she'd read about in storybooks hidden in the actual world. When she set out to combat the commercial whaling industry in the early 70s, most nations' whaling fleets had harpooned themselves out of a job. Stocks of many species were driven so low that hunting whales was unprofitable. But the Russian and Japanese fleets were still at it, while species like the right whale and humpback nosedived toward extinction. McIntyre began lobbying the International Whaling Commission, the multinational body that set hunting quotas, for a 10-year moratorium on all whaling. She wanted at least to hit the pause button so that populations could be better studied and rebound. McIntyre had studying to do herself. She'd never even seen a whale. Starting in 1971, McIntyre made a series of visits to laboratories and aquariums to learn about whale and dolphin intelligence. They were research trips. She called them pilgrimages. And among the most significant was her visit to the Communications Research Institute on St. Thomas. It was the headquarters of an Ivy League-educated neuroscientist named John Lilly, who'd become enchanted with the enormous brains and intelligence of cetaceans while doing research for the U.S. military. Among other things, Lilly was studying mind control, experimenting on dolphin brains as proxies for human ones. Communicating with whales and dolphins became Lilly's life's work. He believed dolphins in particular could be coaxed to speak, to tune and shape their squeals into English words, and he and his colleagues saw themselves as working to usher in a harmonious, bi-species culture of dolphin and man. Among many esteemed visitors to the lab was Carl Sagan, who felt that trying to talk to a dolphin was a prudent practice round for our first contact with extraterrestrials. Sometimes Lilly gave the dolphins LSD. McIntyre was drawn to St. Thomas by a story that was, in a way, a famous precursor to the pseudo-marriage of George and Tex, another sensationalized case of animal-human cohabitation. In 1965, a young woman named Margaret Howe, a hotel worker on the island who'd shown up at the Institute and started helping out, had the idea that creating a need for dolphins to communicate with humans might force a breakthrough, the way exchange students pick up languages abroad. And so she moved in with a bottlenose dolphin named Peter, and they lived together for 2.5 months in a specially constructed, flooded house. There was a kitchenette, an office with a chair and a desk, and a cot, all in 22 inches of water. Their daily schedule resembled that of a language immersion preschool, with Howe patiently trying to teach Peter to say both their names, the numbers 1 to 5, and so on. She wore bright red lipstick so that Peter could better track the movements of her mouth. They also watched television. "No matter how long it takes," Howe assured Lily, "no matter how much work, this dolphin is going to learn to speak English." Like George Archibald, though, Howe had essentially imprisoned herself with the animal and quickly experienced an agonizing loneliness. At night, she cried in her waterlogged bed. She complained of depression, also chafing. The dolphin, meanwhile, wouldn't leave her alone. He squealed over her voice with jealousy when she tried to talk on the phone, and he bruised her shins with his constant prodding. By week 5, Peter was getting frequent erections, which kept him from concentrating on his lessons. So Howe learned to jerk his penis, giving him an orgasm, so he'd calm down. Ultimately, the scientific results were not illuminating. Peter the dolphin did not learn English. But living with an animal became an ascetic, spiritual exercise for Howe, and her reflections on it were fascinating. Her journal was included in Lily's best-selling book, The Mind of the Dolphin. Howe had ideas about how to tweak the experiment in the future to make it more productive. "We owe it to the dolphin and to our curiosity to try it," she wrote. But Lily, ostracized by the scientific establishment, soon lost his funding. In 1967, the Communications Research Institute closed. When Joan McIntyre arrived 4 years later, she found only squalor. Deformed sea turtles swam in the dolphin pool, and the hillside was strewn with trash. Howe was still living on the island, and McIntyre tracked her down. But Howe, disappointed by the way her relationship with Peter had been portrayed in the press, wouldn't disclose much. As McIntyre later put it, everyone saw her as a quirky animal fucker. In retrospect, the Communications Research Institute can be seen as one root of a new kind of empathy for wild animals in America. A feeling that Joan McIntyre would help carry off the island and back to the continental United States. Today, that ethos subtly colors even mainstream conversations about what's at stake in wildlife conservation. And it was maybe even more mainstream back then. In 1972, for example, McIntyre helped bring whales into global focus as icons of the entire environmental movement, the polar bears of their day, by organizing a raucous march at a United Nations conference on the environment in Stockholm. There was a school bus gussied up to look like a whale, and hippies handing flowers to the policemen they passed. But marching alongside McIntyre was former U.S. Secretary of the Interior Walter Hickel, a middle-aged Republican real estate developer in a prim white tennis sweater, waving an American flag. 2 years later, in 1974, McIntyre published what was essentially the holy book of this new whale-friendly worldview, an anthology pulling together many of the people and ideas she'd encountered on her research pilgrimages. It was called Mind in the Waters, a book to celebrate the consciousness of whales and dolphins. Its pages exploded with native legends, scientific treatises on the anatomy of whale brains, beat poetry, briefs on whaling policy, and many drawings of naked people. Though it is obscure now, the book sold well and, as one historian puts it, was embraced as the silent spring of the burgeoning Save the Whales movement. Publicizing the book, McIntyre emerged as a vibrant, unpredictable, and lovably guileless ambassador for the animals. At the time, one newspaper profile noted, most ecological crusaders were edifying dullards. McIntyre, however, carried on about whales as sensual, sexual animals, and about fostering more whale connectedness. For one photo shoot, she spontaneously French kissed an aquarium's killer whale. "I want to make love to a sperm whale," she announced to a Washington Post columnist. For her, the whale was the guardian of the sea's unutterable mysteries and the deep, calm mind of the ocean, connected to body, living in the world, not looking out at it. In short, the animals weren't innocents that we were obligated to protect. They were equals, maybe even superiors. McIntyre was decoupling the meaning of these animals from their ecosystem, warning that the most profound consequences of their extinction could be spiritual, not ecological. Maybe this sounds stale and flaky, the stuff that gets garbled through a cloud of smoke in dorm rooms late at night. But that's just the point. In 1974, this was apparently a fresh and mesmerizing way to talk about wild animals. It was literally news, splashed into the pages of the country's most straight-laced newspapers. McIntyre was making a novel argument for saving species, swirling the outrage and urgency of William Temple Hornaday together with the sentimentality of the nature fakers and dialing up the intensity of both. The result was sexy, heartfelt, explosive, and exuberantly unscientific. A vision of whales as shamanistic creatures who only play, swim, look for food, love, eat, travel, take care of their young and each other, as she told one newspaper. That to me is like a very instructive lifestyle. Their way could be an incredible teacher to us. Since the dawn of modern wildlife conservation a century earlier, the threat to nearly every imperiled species on the continent seemed straightforward enough. People were shooting it. McIntyre was taking the stage at the beginning of a new era, when what menaced wildlife was suddenly oblique. In 1962, Rachel Carson had published Silent Spring, tracing how invisible pollutants like DDT were ricocheting around the environment, wearing away bird species such as the bald eagle, and infiltrating our own bodies. America seemed determined to solve these problems with nothing but more technology. By studying and tracking so many wild animals and atmospheric variables and pollutants that, eventually, we could trace the entire baffling web of Earth's ecology and repair it. In 1970, when a female elk in Wyoming was outfitted with the first-ever satellite tracking collar by NASA and Smithsonian scientists, the contractor that had built the device, a company called Radiation Incorporated, promised in a press release that now only the ability to measure a moving system could prevent extinction of animal species and help bring these menaces to human life under control. In an artist's rendering, the elk, nicknamed Monique the Space Elk, stood with vulnerable doe eyes in a picturesque valley, while the electronic appliance around her neck ejaculated a thick thunderbolt to a satellite in the sky. With whales, McIntyre had locked onto one of the last clear-cut conservation cases, where simply convincing humanity to stop hunting an animal could save it from extinction. But she also saw whales as guides to lure us away from the cerebral attitude toward nature on the rise. John Lilly, a neuroscientist-turned-conservationist, believed that if humans recognized an intellect like our own in whales, we would be moved to protect them. But intellect bored McIntyre. It was, for her, the root of the entire catastrophe, the very thing that had reduced whales to objects to kill and carve. Intellect built the exploding harpoon and industrialize the business of whaling, transforming little wooden boats into mechanized and efficient floating slaughterhouses. Intellect, she wrote in Mind in the Waters, had led us to look down on animals and blinded us to their incredible essence. It had left us incomparably lonely. It is our loneliness as much as our greed which can destroy us. McIntyre's image of pacifist, messianic whales may have been mostly a projection, but the fantasy was appealing, particularly against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. By the time Mind in the Waters was published, she'd formed a nonprofit called Project Jonah, and she and her two-woman staff found themselves backed by celebrities like Candace Bergen and Judy Collins, with a stream of unsolicited donations and lucrative invitations, like the one that brought her to the IBM sales retreat. Project Jonah organized rallies for children and flew three kids to Tokyo to deliver the 26,000 letters and drawings they'd collected from children around the world, asking the Japanese Prime Minister to retire his whaling fleet. Momentum was building. But then, in the summer of 1975, Joan McIntyre watched the anti-whaling movement that she'd been nurturing stand up and walk off in its own direction. On June 27th, a fledgling band of activists from Canada rented a small fishing boat and intercepted a Soviet whaling vessel off the coast of Northern California, in a part of the Pacific known as the Mendocino Ridge. The group called itself Greenpeace. Until then, they'd been focused on the issues of nuclear weapons and power. But they'd learned that sperm whale oil, because of its low freezing point, was still used as a lubricant in the manufacture of nuclear weapons. It seemed like madness. One species driving another extinct in order to build a tool to extinguish itself. All they could think to do was throw themselves in the middle of that madness and try to disrupt it. Two of the men confronted the Soviet ship in a small Zodiac, situating themselves in front of a sperm whale like a human shield. The Russians fired anyway. A 250-pound grenade harpoon streaked over the men's heads and into the back of the whale. Those in the Zodiac stared into the animal's giant eye as it died. A second Greenpeace boat was filming the attack, and a few days later, Walter Cronkite somberly broadcast the footage to millions of Americans. The historian D. Graham Burnett writes that the event galvanized broad and deep public revulsion at modern whaling and modern whalers. It was a turning point. A century earlier, small bands of men huddled in little boats and risked their lives to hunt sperm whales. Now they were ready to trade their lives to save one. Burnett calls the confrontation epoch-defining. It introduced Greenpeace to America and unveiled a more theatrical, militaristic style of environmental campaigning, one that has compelled people to sit in front of trees when the loggers arrive or lie down in front of developers' bulldozers ever since. It believes that nature is worth dying for. And though it is absolutely radical in practice, in theory, it seems to have a fairly wide appeal. One of the young men in the Zodiacs that day was Paul Watson, whose splinter group, Sea Shepherd Society, known for ramming its boats headlong into Japanese whaling vessels, has been the star of Animal Planet's best-rated program since 2008, the reality show Whale Wars. This is to say, the Mendocino Ridge incident signaled the beginning of something powerful in America. But for Joan McIntyre, it was only an end. The episode sickened her. She worried that the tack Greenpeace had taken with the Russians could escalate out of control into an international incident, maybe even nuclear war. Having recently briefed one of Greenpeace's founders on the whaling issue, hoping to get the group involved, she now felt curiously betrayed. For her, saving whales had been about clearing more space for compassion in the world. Whales were role models to increase our ability to get along with one another and be affectionate and reestablish our connections, she later remembered. Now there was this heroic, macho event where people are chasing Russian ships around and potentially catalyzing violence. That was the betrayal. taking something that I believed was gentle and turning it into something warlike. Our natural ability to go wrong was manifesting itself. It solidified something in McIntyre's mind. She'd been noticing that her efforts to increase empathy only backfired or fed old antagonisms. Among the letters to the Japanese Prime Minister she collected from kids, for example, she'd found more than a few attacking the Japs for being such barbarians. It seemed to her that good intentions were easily disfigured after too much exposure to the world, like metal corroding in the elements. There was something ugly and self-defeating in humans, or at least hapless, that always rose up to confound any progress. It was similar to how, 10 years later, the crowd for Humphrey the Humpback would ravage a butterfly's habitat, and how a fence meant to protect the Antioch Dunes nearly tore them apart. More recently, after I stopped visiting the dunes, I read that Fish and Wildlife had determined that 3 herbicides it was spraying to control weeds there had probably been killing 25% to 30% of the butterfly larvae every year. All our efforts to control our future, McIntyre wrote, are like ants walking around a Mobius strip. She wasn't angry with Greenpeace, but she felt that whale activism had now shifted onto a new plane, one where she wasn't needed or useful. In 1977, she dropped the cause entirely. She moved to the small Hawaiian island of Lanai, where she lived in a tent on a cliff. She wanted to watch the whales, the actual whales, and did so with a childlike diligence that brought to mind Rudy Mattoni, withdrawing into his land in Uruguay to catalog the bugs. Before, McIntyre wrote, whales were symbols flopping around inside my mind. Now she perceived the gigantic distance between the reality of the whales that I was watching from the cliff on Lanai and the effort to save them. Eventually, she moved to Fiji, where she married a native man, changed her name to Joanna Varawa, and, after quietly publishing a couple of rambling memoirs, basically disappeared. I'd approached McIntyre's story as one in a series, pulling apart the different ways in which America has thought about and cherished its wildlife over the last 250 years, from Thomas Jefferson's time through William Temple Hornaday's and up until my own. These aren't attitudes that switch on and off. Instead, they've been draped over animals and on top of each other like translucent silk scarves, so that by now their patterns meld into something new and are no longer easily decipherable. So, having read so much about Joan McIntyre, I found it strange to watch the actual woman step off a ferry boat in downtown San Francisco to meet me one morning recently, nimble but worn-looking, with all that fire-red hair spilling from a faded baseball cap. It was as though she'd come hurtling out of history to give me a hug and tell the barista her name, Joanna, so we'd know when her Americano was ready. I tracked down Joanna Varawa on Lanai, where she now lives again, working as an artist and writing an online community newsletter. She was back in the Bay Area, visiting her son and grandchildren for the first time in almost a decade. On the phone, she'd laughed when I'd asked if she still wanted to make love to a sperm whale, and laughed at what she called her youthful and naive belief that if we could save the whales, we could save the earth, even though that's exactly what Robert Buchanan had told me in Churchill about polar bears, and he believed it in his bones. She told me right away that she didn't disown anything she'd done with Project Jonah, but she was disillusioned. The pointlessness and folly that she'd glimpsed at the Mendocino Ridge, our species' absurdity, she called it, is only more apparent to her now. The ultimate path in front of us appears to be the total extinction of everything, she said. But she was laughing when she said that, too. And when I pointed that out, she shot back, well, because what else are you going to do? In short, I was relieved not to find yet another crabby and wounded ex-environmentalist, and I asked her how she was managing to live in a world that she found so discouraging. The answer wasn't reassuring. She told me about the Taoists in ancient China. They looked around and saw they were facing the same situation, a world that was disintegrating around them, and they realized the best thing to do is do as little as possible. Don't feed any new energy into a system that's falling apart, because you don't know what that energy will wind up being spit back as. Rather than try to change society, it's better to retreat. You try to stay virtuous in your immediate life. You try to be correct, because you only feed the monster if you interfere too much. That was why she disappeared after the Mendocino Ridge, she said. She was done interfering. Joanna told me that she'd gone on to one more International Whaling Commission meeting first, however. It was in Canberra, Australia, in 1977. The scene saddened her. Outside, she said, herds of new Save the Whales organizations were jockeying for money, influence, and attention. Inside, non-whaling nations traded their whaling quotas to Russia and Japan in exchange for increasing their fishing quotas. It was like a stock exchange to divvy up Earth's living things. The real turning point came when she met a Japanese delegate who told her that he now spent more than 200 days of every year flying to and from fisheries meetings just like this one. She looked deep into his exhausted eyes and saw a man trapped in needless and hopeless complexity. She pitied him, she told me, and as she described it, I couldn't help think of the much smaller squabbles flaring in the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership among all those people who only wanted to save a beautiful bird. My original intention was to soften things, she told me, and this was just all getting so hard. So she left. Early the next morning, she bought up all the daffodils she could find in downtown Canberra, and before anyone arrived for that day's meetings, she placed a few on every conference table. Then she went to the airport and flew home. And that, Joanna said, laughing, was my last act as a whale saver. Around Thanksgiving, Operation Migration caught a streak of good weather and rallied. The cranes were locking into the trikes and had built up enough stamina that during some flights, the pilots found they could skip a stopover and keep pushing the flock to the next one. During one 8-day stretch, the team flew on 4 different mornings, shredding through 7 migration stops and 350 miles, and catapulting the cranes out of Kentucky, through Tennessee, and across the Alabama state line. There was talk of finishing the migration before Christmas, which hadn't happened since 2004. Still, there was one ongoing headache. Crane number 2. The same bird that had freaked out and retreated into the woods that first morning in Nisida. Shortly after, the crew discovered that the bird had somehow sustained an injury, a nasty abrasion along the leading edge of its wing. It was ripped up, with feathers and fibers dangling from the flesh. After the wound was treated, number 2 seemed to recover quickly. Soon it raced out of the pen in the morning with the rest of the gang and thrust out its wings as though it were going to spurt into the sky. But it seldom left the ground. And when it did get airborne, it bailed out after a quarter mile at most and had to be tracked down on foot by OM's costumed ground crew. Often the bird would land deep in the woods or far off the road in a gauntlet of farm fields and 6-foot-deep irrigation ditches, and the ground crew would have to hike in after it, then hoist it in a wooden crate on their backs all the way back to their van. Experience shows that a whooping crane can be driven a few legs of the migration and still learn the route, though it's unclear how many exactly. One morning, number 2 did lift off from the pen, but then rocketed straight into the top of a tree, ricocheted down through the branches pachinko-like, and landed with its legs wrenched open in a V. For weeks, this one problem child siphoned up a tremendous amount of Operation Migration's time and patience. By the time they'd reached Tennessee, number 2 had become the subject of many internal emails and conference calls between the WESEP partners. Almost everyone in OM was convinced that the bird was incapable of flying, that the torn wing had been more serious than anyone realized. But the scientists at Patuxent argued that number 2's problem might only be psychological, that the bird had been traumatized and needed to work through a fear of the trike. One government researcher told me that Operation Migration seemed to be giving up on the bird too easily. My attitude was, try harder. This is what you're there for, to deal with the difficult ones, not just the easy ones. In the end, the partners consented to have the bird driven to a vet in Nashville. After an X-ray showed that number two had, in fact, ripped a membrane in its wing and would never fly normally again, the bird was taken out of the migration and sent back to Patuxent. Taking a whooping crane to the vet on migration is not like taking a house cat to the vet. Someone first had to go ahead, Secret Service-like, to secure the clinic. Barking dogs were cleared out. Phones were silenced. The doctor was outfitted with a hood and white costume. Actual local headline, Nashville vet dresses like a marshmallow to save whooping crane. But by then, the whole debate about the bird between Operation Migration and the other partners seemed to have dragged out and gone sideways in that special, galling way that disagreements between unhappy spouses do. The intensity of those conversations, at least on Operation Migration's side, was probably amplified by a more serious disagreement developing that fall. During a parallel series of conference calls, a team of WESEP members, including a representative from OM, was hashing out a new long-range plan for the partnership. And by now, WESEP's intensifying commitment to putting its work back on firm, scientific footing was presenting an existential threat to Operation Migration. The pilots were being argued out of their jobs. WESEP's initial goal had been to release a new troop of whooping cranes at Nisida every fall until it had built up a self-sustaining population of between 100 and 125 birds. Whooping cranes that were nesting and breeding at Nisida at a healthy rate and autonomously teaching their young the way to Florida. Only then could the humans stand down. With 100 birds now soaring down the flyway, WESEP was extremely close to reaching that goal. Many of the cranes did nest and mate in Wisconsin, but they routinely abandoned their eggs. After 10 years, only one chick had survived long enough at Nisida to follow its parents to Florida. The discouraging truth was that, although large numbers of whooping cranes had been miraculously conjured into a place where previously there'd been absolutely none, those cranes weren't yet taking care of themselves. Whooping cranes would continue to live in Wisconsin only if humans kept breeding them and putting them there. That is, the reintroduction was working fantastically. But, looked at in a narrower and less forgiving way, it was still a near-total failure. And so, earlier that year, a high-ranking panel of government scientists and conservationists, known as the International Whooping Crane Recovery Team, decided not to allow any more whooping crane chicks to be trained for migration at Nisida until the breeding problem was studied exhaustively and solved. One theory was that an infestation of black flies was biting and hounding the cranes until they were forced off their nests. But there was also vague concern in the partnership that the problem could be less straightforward, that maybe, being reared by a big white costume instead of a bird, had written some inscrutable glitch into the programming of these cranes, making them lousy parents. Pledging more animals to that stalled population seemed unwise at this point, like potentially throwing them away. Operation Migration could shift its base of operations to another site next spring and still lead a new group of cranes on migration. But that meant zeroing in on a piece of suitable habitat, evaluating that land with a battery of scientific tests, then getting the requisite pile of permits completed before the next spring. A ruthlessly tight schedule. And many in WESEP were adamant that they'd rather miss the deadline and leave Operation Migration behind than rush into anything haphazardly. There were now also alternative ideas for teaching cranes to migrate surfacing in the partnership. For the last several years, for example, the International Crane Foundation has been releasing a small number of juvenile, captive-reared cranes near the adult whoopers already at Nisida and coaxing them to follow those older birds south instead of an ultralight. In short, they're starting to succeed in doing what they'd once done with sandhill cranes, but it seemed impossible to pull off with whooping cranes, at the outset of the reintroduction. For some in WESEP, the breeding deadlock at Nisida seemed to clear a perfect space in which to pause and dedicate more resources to investigating these new techniques. And in certain corners of the partnership, there was only low-grade sympathy at best for OM's predicament. John French, Patuxent's research director, told me, "Decisions should be based now on data. They need to be made for the good of the project and the good of the birds. If that means that OM isn't part of the project anymore, then that's the way it goes. So be it." By late November, with the crew's pace slowing through central Alabama, finding and vetting a new piece of land in time to launch an ultralight migration the following year started to seem impossible. One night, scooping leftover barbecue onto a paper plate in a host family's kitchen, Joe Duff pulled me aside and quietly admitted that he was all but convinced this would be Operation Migration's last migration. If they were forced to stand down next year, they could never rebound, their funding would dry up, and the crew would take other jobs. He felt bad that he couldn't go public with that news yet, he told me. He would have liked to give the many craniacs along the route a proper goodbye. As improbable as it sounds, there was actually a second, smaller band of costumed whooping crane conservationists barreling south behind us in campers and vans that fall. A kind of shadow operation, a couple of states back, but gaining ground. This was WESEP's tracking team. The tracking team, primarily staffed with young biologists from the International Crane Foundation, has been charged with monitoring all the other birds in the population, the 100 whooping cranes now migrating south independently, and especially those making the trip on their own for the first time. Every crane has a transmitter around its leg that spits out a blip on a personalized radio frequency. The trackers drive ahead of the birds, plotting their positions and progress as they go. Early in the morning, they stake out the cranes' last known locations to try to get eyes on the birds, and they collect reports from a network of bird-watching cooperators in various states. They do this all fall, until the birds get to Florida. Then, in the spring, they do the whole thing again in reverse, chasing the birds on their migration back to Wisconsin. Sometimes there is a hands-on element to the tracker's work. If a bird winds up somewhere it shouldn't be, a playground, a hunting ground, hundreds of miles off course on the opposite side of Lake Michigan instead of en route back to Nisida, the trackers are ready to flush the bird or even suit up in a white crane costume, grab the crane, and drive it somewhere better. You can imagine the trackers as white-robed guardian angels, watching over the cranes and rescuing ones that get into trouble. Or you can see them as a roving goon squad, abducting and re-educating any birds who don't follow the rules. That same ambiguity smolders inside many other endangered species recoveries, too. Around America, wildlife managers are laboring to negotiate the same sorts of impossible boundaries between animals and the human world, or even between animals and other animals, policing their wildness. Bison that wander out of Yellowstone Park have been pushed back across the line, for fear they'll transmit diseases to livestock. When red wolves were reintroduced in North Carolina, the animals were outfitted with special collars that could be triggered remotely to stick the wolves in the neck with a sedative. It was a kind of kill switch, in case the humans who were monitoring them saw an animal signal wander outside a certain designated territory, but couldn't get on the ground quickly enough to intercept it. In other parts of the country, if reintroduced gray wolves can't be kept off ranch land and they kill a rancher's cow, state governments or conservation groups have simply reimbursed the rancher for his losses. Wildlife officials have used paintball guns to push moose out of traffic on Interstate 90 in eastern Washington. In Alaska, they use tasers. In Texas, as part of its reintroduction of rare desert bighorn sheep, the state has sent out marksmen to gun down preemptively the animals it sees as competitors to the bighorns, clearing feral donkeys and elk out of their way, as well as another non-native species of sheep called the owdad. Since 2001, a division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture called Wildlife Services has shot an average of 600 coyotes a week from helicopters to clear western lands for domesticated sheep or cows, or to protect mule deer. And near Cape Cod, where summer feeding grounds of the world's last 350 North Atlantic right whales coincide with a busy shipping lane, with boats charging in and out of a liquefied natural gas terminal, Cornell University has installed a network of high-tech buoys to listen for the animals 24 hours a day. 10-second audio clips of possible whale calls are uploaded to a lab at the university, where analysts, working around the clock during the busiest times of year, verify these calls and warn any ships in the vicinity to slow down. Zoom out, and what you see is one species, us, struggling to keep all others in their appropriate places, or at least in the places we've sometimes arbitrarily decided they ought to stay. In some areas, we want cows but not bison, or mule deer but not coyotes, or cars but not elk, or sheep but not elk, or bighorn sheep but not owdad sheep, or else we'd like wolves and cows in the same place, or natural gas tankers swimming harmoniously with whales. We are everywhere in the wilderness with white gloves on, directing traffic. In an Environmental Law Review article on the subject, the scholar Holly DeRamis criticizes this sort of restrictive wildlife management as erecting a virtual cage around animals. Conservation should strive to build healthy populations of animals that are as wild as possible in a tame world. But controlling and manipulating animals, or making apologies and payouts for them, effectively amounts to a kind of domestication, changing species from wild animals to human creations designed to serve human needs. Just as a cow on a fenced-in pasture meets America's need for beef, a buffalo scrupulously contained inside a national park meets America's need for buffalo. Our need to keep them contributing, via their species' various ecosystem services, to a healthy ecosystem, or just our aesthetic and moral needs to know that buffalo exist there, and to keep their destruction off our conscience. This work goes more gracefully at some intersections of people and animals than others. I learned about one management scheme that failed so badly that when some environmentalists talk about it now, it can sound like an allegory or a farce. In 1987, the government decided to relocate 140 Pacific sea otters, a species once believed to be extinct, from their last redoubt on the Northern California coast to an unpopulated island far to the south, near Santa Barbara. As with the eastern migratory population of whooping cranes, the idea was to seed a second, discrete population of otters as a catastrophic insurance policy. Not everyone in Southern California welcomed the otters, however. Commercial fishermen saw them as competitors for abalone and urchin, and the oil industry worried they'd complicate its plans to drill nearby. So those engineering the otter recovery cut a deal. They drew a line around a large swath of ocean and promised that if any of the otters left the island and penetrated that area, the government would trap them and move them back. The area stretched 300 miles down the coast, all the way to the Mexican border. People called it the otter-free zone. Essentially, it was zoned for fishermen, but not sea otters, just as a downtown neighborhood might be zoned for light industrial use, but not residential. Most of the otters were affixed with radio tags, but not very effective ones. The signal couldn't be detected more than 2 miles away, and the batteries ran out after 90 days. A few otters were outfitted with more sophisticated tracking devices, but those had to be implanted surgically. And so a telephone hotline was set up. The public would report any otters they saw on the wrong side of that invisible line. And over the next several years, a biologist named Greg Sanders drove around Southern California responding to calls. He would arrive on the scene often days later and stare into kelp beds with a telescope for hours. Sometimes the otter turned out to be a sea lion or only a floating log. Often Sanders found nothing. There was an otter in a haystack feeling to the work. After 6 years, 24 trespassing otters had been captured and removed from the otter exclusion zone. Each was driven or flown in a chartered plane to a release point hundreds of miles north, at a reported cost of $6,000 to $12,000 per otter. At least four otters died after being moved, probably from stress. Two others immediately swam back to where Sanders had trapped them. In 1993, the government finally gave up enforcing the otter-free zone. Sanders told reporters, "The underlying message is, otters don't stay where we put them." Originally, the posse of whooping crane trackers was assembled by WESEP to do the same job as Greg Sanders: make sure that wild animals respected certain legal agreements that had been brokered by human beings, and which, of course, the birds could have no conception of. Before WESEP could let any whooping cranes loose, to fly and land wherever they pleased, potentially carrying with them some of the protections and restrictions associated with endangered species, the partnership had to negotiate with 20 different states in and around the proposed flyway, reassuring them that it could retrieve any birds that touched down where they weren't wanted. In 10 years, relatively few birds have had to be snatched and relocated. But what's clear in the stories of the ones that have is that the trackers aren't just policing the law. They're policing an aesthetic, making sure that the whooping cranes we have created behave like the aloof and magisterially wild ones in our imaginations. The wildness of an individual whooping crane is a fragile, slippery commodity. In the run-up to reintroduction, scientists experimented with actively conditioning the cranes to avoid people by waving shiny balloons at them, running at the birds while screaming, or rapidly opening and shutting an umbrella. Firing shell crackers during a charge is also helpful, one scientific report noted. Less than helpful has been our few attempts to use chemical mace, an electrical cattle prod, pepper spray, and lemon oil spray to promote wildness. In other words, there was an acknowledgement right away that the costume doesn't make the birds wild. It only keeps them from getting inadvertently tamed by prolonged exposure to the person hiding underneath it. Ultimately, every crane decides for itself what distance to keep from humans when, after learning the way to Florida and striking out on its own, it's finally allowed to encounter us out in the open and unmasked. And some birds, despite WESEP's best intentions, have exhibited a distressing nonchalance. Whooping cranes have turned up in suburban backyards and trailer parks. One liked to roost in a retention pond near a Walmart. One was seen strolling into a barn. Another male kept landing inside a zoo in Florida, drawn to the captive female whooping crane that lived there. Once, the WESEP trackers had to fish him out of the zoo's bear enclosure. In the summer of 2009, another male crane became a fixture at an ethanol plant near Nisida, feeding on vast piles of waste corn, oblivious to the truck traffic grunting in and out. That bird was eventually yanked from the population entirely. Its wildness had been compromised, and it was a bad influence, luring other whoopers to the ethanol plant with it. It lives in a zoo in Tampa now and goes by the name Colonel. Cases like these have forced the question within WESEP of what wild even means. What should a population of wild whooping cranes look like in 21st century America? It would be easy to say that a wild animal is one that lives outside human influence and beyond human contact, an animal that doesn't notice us or give a damn. But in that case, true wildness would be almost impossible, with human influence now bleeding into virtually all the available space. Even WESEP's trackers don't have a written definition of wildness or any empirical metrics to enforce it with. How far away from a Walmart a wild crane should stay? Ultimately, wildness is a matter of individual opinion, and not even the experts agree. Inside WESEP, there are wildness fundamentalists and those who take a more libertarian tack. When I visited Patuxent one summer, John French, the research director, told me that lately he's poked at this confusion in the partnership, the squishiness of what wildness is, by asking his colleagues to do little thought experiments. Suppose, for example, that the partnership managed to establish a large and healthy population of whooping cranes in Wisconsin with 25 or even 50 breeding pairs, each fledging 2 chicks every year. But suppose those birds nested on golf courses and frequently had to be hazed off the back 9, like Canada geese. On a visceral level, French said, this would feel like a disaster. The romance of the whooping crane is bound up in its being not just a wild animal, but a very wild animal, he told me. That wildness drew America to the whooping crane's cause in the first place. And after such a long fight, who wants to see whoopers wandering around a parking lot eating French fries? I certainly don't. But French also said he might have to force himself to accept such a scenario as success. Our vision of wildness may be impossibly nostalgic, an almost religious fantasy of purity in what's remote, in what's beyond us, not unlike the gentle deities that Joan McIntyre saw in Wales. It may be unfair to expect actual whooping cranes in the 21st century to behave the way we imagined whooping cranes did in the 16th century. In a world full of Costco regional distribution centers and Krispy Kreme drive-thrus, we are asking them to block it all out, to see the Walmart retention pond as a slum instead of a providential new form of habitat in a changing world, and to see the corn piling up outside an ethanol plant not as food but as waste product, and to decide, as we have, that eating it is beneath their species' dignity. Maybe we want the cranes to be anachronisms, to live in an avian version of colonial Williamsburg, by the code of their ancestors, and without whatever tools the modern world might provide for them. French conceded that the entire Truman Show-esque existence that's been concocted for these cranes in pursuit of that wild ideal may not even be the best thing for the birds. Let's face it, he said, the animals that survive and thrive are those that do well in and around a human-oriented landscape. The purest triumphs of conservation may be the species that rebound so phenomenally that they become nuisances to us on our own turf, wiggling off wildlife refuges and into niches that we didn't expressly clear for them. Think of the white-tailed deer, an animal William Temple Hornaday presumed to be doomed in the Northeast a century ago in Our Vanishing Wildlife. The same story has played out to a less exaggerated degree around the country with cormorants, pelicans, and sandhill cranes. Or consider giant Canada geese, which were once presumed extinct in the United States until a single remnant flock was discovered in 1962. Panicked scientists held scientific symposia focused on the bird's preservation, and even as late as the early 80s, geese were being reintroduced around the country and fed rations of corn through the winter by state governments. Now there are 3.5 million of them in America. They're so numerous that they get sucked into jet engines and take down commercial flights. And the federal government rounds up and gasses untold thousands every year. Even pigeons were once cherished in American cities, before all the handouts and garbage we've given them to eat allowed their numbers to explode. In 1878, the New York Times described pigeons as honest birds whose right to feed in the street was being challenged by sparrows. In the early 1930s, a community of gentlemanly pigeon feeders in front of the White House hoped that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt might come out to join in their highly developed art. It's hard to square our nostalgia for certain rare species with our resentment of species like these that we've helped to thrive, intentionally or unintentionally. It's a thin and erratic line we draw between the wildness that awes us and the wildness that only annoys us. It's a reminder that we remake the animal landscape on timescales longer than our imaginations are calibrated to perceive or predict, and that we can't predict how we'll feel about those changes either. At Antioch Dunes, I'd been unsettled by how shifting baseline syndrome cloaks the past, warping our understanding of what's been lost. But it hadn't occurred to me to project the problem of shifting baselines into the future, too. to wonder where what we're building and preserving is heading, and if it will be judged differently by those who inherit it. A root of the problem appears to be that, even though empirical targets are typically laid out in the government's recovery plans, X number of whooping cranes, and so on, the people steering those recoveries have been working so hard for so long to prevent the chastening failure of the species extinction that they can't quite envision what success should actually look like in the real world. As John French told me at Patuxent, at this point, work on any endangered species is certainly a very severe rearguard effort. In our meetings in WESEP, we don't talk about underlying philosophies of humans and the natural world. We talk about what we're going to do next week and who's got enough money to buy food. But there's also a fickleness to our attitudes about wildlife over time that I hadn't acknowledged. And like the problems of shifting baselines and climate change that I'd come across before, it creates one more cavernous and disorienting ambiguity at the heart of conservation. America is scrambling to save so much and should be. But, as Holly Doremus writes, we've never asked how much wild nature society needs and how much society can accept. I decided not to take Isla out on migration that fall. Partly, it was because I didn't want to subject her to the miserable logistics of crane chasing, to schlep her across the country to some deep southern backwater motel and wake her before dawn 4 or 5 mornings in a row in case the wind happened to blow in precisely the correct direction at a cooperative clip. I remembered, as we'd stood by at Nisida, waiting to see whether Operation Migration would finally lift off, how I'd watched the defeat expand in the eyes of the Japanese television crew's cameraman, how tired he looked, and how, over the course of that week, his face gradually surrendered to a beard. I had mixed feelings about inflicting that hassle on my little girl, and I wasn't sure it was worth it. By now, the momentary sight of a few white birds flapping behind a plane at a flyover event almost felt secondary. Whatever story I was following at this point wasn't about the breathtaking inscrutability of animals, but of people. I do remember, though, how, early one morning when Isla was 3 and a half, she and I caught sight of 3 raccoons outside our kitchen window. A fat one right in front of us, the size of a small schnauzer, scampered back and forth along the wall of our little cement backyard. 2 others, one big, one small, clambered up the posts of our neighbor's deck, then down again, then up. "Baby raccoon," Isla said in an explosive stage whisper. We watched, rapt, as they hurried to do whatever raccoons try to get done before sunrise. They were Isla's first raccoons. I like raccoons. I can't understand why they're so underappreciated. Not detested like rats or opossums, maybe, but not known for delivering thrills either. They're surely one of the most cuddly-looking and admirable synanthropes, what biologists call species that succeed in the human environment. In the last 70 years, the number of raccoons living in North American cities has grown 20-fold. I'd read that President Coolidge's family kept a pet raccoon named Rebecca at the White House. A 1963 essay in Harper's Magazine titled "Our Most American Animal" even proposed that the raccoon be elevated alongside the bald eagle as a second national symbol. The raccoon's character, the essay argued, is our character. The animal embodies everything that separates the new world from the old: toughness, adaptability, self-reliance, a devotion to being busy. Nothing about him is rare, delicate, or specialized. He is as common as dirt and as hardy as weeds. When the raccoons moved on, Isla asked me to pour her a bowl of Cheerios. Our day started up as usual. She rarely mentions watching polar bears in Churchill, but from time to time, she asks me if I remember that very special time we got to see raccoons.